Coming right up is Dr. Rob Stahl, geriatrician, bringing you the only local call-in program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. At Your Age is the name of the program. Stay tuned to WHLD AM 1270 for this worthwhile and important show. This is the station of the nation's Sound of Falls, AM 1270, WHLD. 3 o'clock, it's time for At Your Age with Dr. Rob Stahl.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I'd been out till quarter to three, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. Today is Monday, August 8th, 2005, and welcome to today's show. The show is being graciously sponsored by two wonderful medical organizations, Vascular Interventional Associates and Buffalo Spine and Sports Institute. I have two great guests here today, ready and willing to take your calls. The number to phone with your questions is 855-6848. Feel free to call anytime during the show. Interrupt us right in the middle of a sentence, and we want to hear from you. Last month, we discussed home care services with Lisa Greisler of VNA Home Care Services and Marilyn Green of Coordinated Care. If you missed the show, you can hear it on the show's website, along with all my other shows at whatshouldyouexpect.com, all one word except for the dot. Also, look for the shows to download into your iPod at the iTunes Podcasts site under Health. I don't know how many of you have iPods out there, but if you don't, I would recommend you run out and get them, and you can listen to the show wherever you are, whenever you want. If you're not web-connected, contact me at 636-7531, and I'd be happy to mail you a CD of the show. Now, I was going to go through the expectations for older adults. We'll save that for next time. They're available at the website, and there's something for you to look at, read, keep in mind, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. The topic for today is hip fractures, spine fractures, and osteoporosis. I'm happy to have with me today two experts on the topic. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. Iqbal of Vascular Interventional Associates. Dr. Iqbal, welcome.
Hi.
And please tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became an interventional radiologist, why you're on the show, and you can start whenever you want. You can start at 5 years of age, 20 years of age, whatever you feel is important. Go right ahead.
Well, it seems that the time before the med school is a blur, but I went to med school.
I know what you mean.
I went to med school at State University of New York, Brooklyn. It used to be called Downstate Medical. Then I started out in a surgical training program up at Westchester County Medical Center. In the second year of my general surgery, I met up with the interventional radiologist there. And that really inspired me to look at what I'm doing and where I'm going, because here was this person, and he was able to do most of the things that used to be done with the help of an open operation under the guidance of CAT scan and x-rays. And after that, I changed my track, and I went into radiology to become an interventional radiologist. I did my training at Montefiore Medical Center in New York City, and then I did my fellowship at St. Luke's Roosevelt with Columbia. I graduated, came to Buffalo in 97, and I've been here since.
That's great. Now, give three examples of interventional radiology and what used to be done by a surgeon that's now done by an interventional radiologist.
Sure. I'll give you an example in three different areas. The treatment of things like peripheral arterial disease, basically blockages of arteries, usually by atherosclerotic disease, used to be that you would require a bypass to treat the disease area of the blood vessel.
Or a surgeon would cut in and go to the vessel and then put a new vessel bypassing the blockage.
Exactly. And that's almost obsolete in most cases. Most cases now, those areas can be opened using small balloons, angioplasty balloons, stents, and even arthrectomy devices. And this is all done under X-ray guidance while the patient is awake, with a small nick in the artery in the groin or the arm as needed.
And they go home that same day, presumably. Same day,
yes,
right.
Yes.
Okay, number two.
Number two. That's actually a hot topic nowadays. I don't know if you heard the news about Dr. Rice, Condoleezza Rice, who had her fibroids treated. These are very
uterine fibroids. Right,
uterine fibroids, they're very common in women over 35 years of age. About one in three women have it. They can become symptomatic because of their mass or their location. And the general treatment used to be, after the medications fail, would be to have a hysterectomy. Now there's this new treatment called uterine artery embolization, where you actually put a small catheter in, just like you would do an angiogram, into the blood vessels which actually supply blood to these fibroids, and then block those small vessels going to the fibroids with small inert balls. And the fibroids do shrink, they start shrinking after the procedure, and generally it's effective in about 90 to 95% of the patients after a month or two.
It's like causing a stroke of the fibroids.
Exactly. And then these fibroids become small and inactive with time.
That's amazing. Huh. And number three.
Number three is something, is the advancement of minimally invasive procedure for treatment of spine fractures, that I think that we'll be speaking about a little bit more in detail later on. There's a procedure called kyphoplasty, which is when there's a spine fracture, it is reduced, and then it is stabilized internally with a putty like cement.
And by when you say reduced, what does that mean?
Well, spine fractures which occur in the body of the vertebral body, they're actually a compression type which make the vertebral body almost into a wedge rather than a normal rectangular type of form. And what we do is that we try to bring it back to its original shape and then stabilize it by putting a putty like cement internally.
So reducing, in medical terminology, is actually expanding, in this case, expanding the part of the spine that's
indeed
collapsed back
indeed
to its normal shape.
Indeed.
That's amazing.
And this is all done with local anesthesia and with the medication, the IV. And patients can literally walk that same day.
We're going to definitely talk more about that, along with some other things. As radiologists are key to helping other medical specialties diagnose osteoporosis, fractures, and that sort of thing. And interestingly enough, I was planning to go into radiology when a radiologist came up to me and said, it's good to have a grounding in internal medicine before you go into radiology. So I went the internal medicine route, and then I got grabbed by another person who inspired me, and therefore I am now a geriatrician, internist geriatrician. So, but I have a love for radiology, and I love doing procedures, the few little procedures that I do. Next, we have Dr. Deborah Bergfeld of Buffalo Spine and Sports Institute. Welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very glad you're here. And tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing over at Buffalo Spine and Sports, and also your a specialty of medicine that I utilize a lot in my practice. I refer many patients to a rehabilitation medicine doctor who is not a surgeon, and is not a physical therapist, but is a physician that specializes in rehabilitation medicine. So why don't you tell us all about those kinds of things?
Yeah. Well, I attended the University of Buffalo Medical School and then was off to Chicago for my training in physical medicine and rehabilitation. And a lot of people out there aren't really 100% sure what our field particularly is about, and that is my specialty training. We're also called physiatrists, if anyone ever hears that term. And there's two sort of areas of the specialty in general. One is the rehabilitation part, which often just deals with disability and helping people to function better despite whatever their medical diagnosis is and whatever their particular disability is. And as you mentioned, we utilize physical therapists, occupational therapists, many different therapy fields, often speech therapists. And then there's sort of the physical medicine side, which encompasses more non-surgical orthopedic care. So anything from back injuries, hips, knees, any care that you would potentially have involving your musculoskeletal system, we can help you to take care of from a non-surgical standpoint. So as far as pain management and then also rehabilitation. That is my particular specialty, and I've sort of the newest addition. I did recently move from Chicago to join up with the folks at the Buffalo Spine and Sports Institute. So my focus is, again, as I mentioned, this non-surgical treatment of orthopedic problems. And we do that through pain management, through medications, through some little bit of different interventional kind of treatments. We can sometimes do spinal injections, things like that. And then we also guide physical therapists in a very specific treatment program for people. And our main focus is on functioning, helping you to function better in your daily life, whether that's an athlete who can't run a marathon or the person who just can't wash their dishes and cook comfortably and make it through their day that way. We sort of focus on what everybody's particular goals are for them.
Yeah, and to function, key to functioning is to relieving pain, and pain certainly is a big focus of your practice, and you do refer to surgeons when that's appropriate.
Exactly.
I'm a success story of your practice. One of your partners, Dr. Mike DeRacy, performed an epidural on me, and it helped me with my back pain.
That's
terrific. Well, it's great having you both here. Now, we're talking about hip fractures, spine fractures, and osteoporosis. These things are very common in older people, cause a lot of problems when they do occur, and we want to talk about what they are, each, who's at risk for them, and how to prevent in the first half of the show. The second half of the show, we'll get into some examples, concrete examples, and also how to treat, what's the best way to treat them. So why don't we start with definitions. Hip fracture. I know you know, people know where the hip is, and when someone says a hip fracture, a lot of people don't really know what that is. You know, there's no bone that's actually the hip. And who wants to give a shot? Why don't we start with you, Debbie? What actually is a hip fracture?
Okay. Well, hip fractures can encompass actually a relatively large group of pathologic processes. So that what makes up the hip is actually, it's the top of the long bone of your leg, the femur. So it's the longest bone in your leg, and it's the one closest to your, actually what you think of as the hip. And oftentimes the fracture involves the top of that bone, or what we call the femoral head. It can involve inside the capsule of the hip, where it sort of fits into the pelvis. It can be on the neck. There's a neck portion to the femur there, or it can involve below that. And there can actually be a pure break of the bone, where part of the bone becomes offset or displaced, is what someone will say, and that often requires some sort of surgical treatment, whether that's a hip replacement or a partial hip replacement or some sort of other surgical intervention like a nail or a rod. And then other times there can be simply fractures which we call stress fractures, which are not pure true breaks that we think of as in the bone breaking in half or apart, but more more micro stress, micro fractures that we can see that are due to wear and tear and stress lines over time.
Now, Dr. Iqbal, what do these look like on an x-ray? And to simplify, basically what you said, Debbie, is that we have the pelvis that is the bone at the base of our torso, I guess you would say. And then the femur, the long bone of the leg, has this round little ball at the end that kind of fits into a socket, and it rotates. That allows it to rotate and have all the mobility that your leg has. And it breaks in that area, right at that head, or further down the shaft, and that are called hip fractures. Something that's further down the leg towards the knee wouldn't be called a hip fracture. That would be called a long bone fracture or a femur fracture. So what does this look like? And the difference between it being in the capsule, which is closer to the pelvis, and outside of the capsule is very important because there's more blood vessels in the capsule area versus outside the capsule area. So see, Dr. Iqbal.
Indeed, there are different presentations of it, you know, whether if there's a fracture that is non-displaced, meaning that that there's a crack in the bone, but it's not moved away from each other, versus a displaced fracture where the two ends are not in close proximity. And then there's also, you can have a fracture and dislocation. It mentioned where the head of the femur is dislocated from its corresponding, shall we say, bone socket. Depending on the modality that you use, like for example, if you use plain hip x-rays, you can actually see the break, if there's a break, and the movement of the head of the femur away from this socket if there's one present. And a similar presentation can be seen on a CAT scan. However, in patients who are severely osteoporotic, where the bone density is very thin, a lot of times non-displaced fractures are not picked up or missed on plain x-rays. And they actually present a special diagnostic problem because, A, the bones are not dense enough to give you a good x-ray picture. There's not enough calcium there to stop the light energy or the x-ray energy, which you see on the films as being printed as negative or positive. And in those cases, actually, if the clinical symptoms are not explained by the findings on the x-ray, the best test probably is either a bone scan or an MRI.
And those symptoms would most likely be pain and the inability to use the joint properly.
Right. Okay. Weight bear.
Right.
And I find that probably MRI is the single best test in that case because depending on the weighted sequence that's used on the MRI, one can actually see bone edema or marrow edema in the area where there may be a non-displaced fracture.
So if someone has, let's say, had a fall, went for x-rays, has pain in the hip, and nothing shows up, but they continue to have pain on the days and even weeks subsequent to that, there might be a pretty good chance that there's one of these invisible fractures?
Well, there are many reasons to have pain. There could be injury to ligaments, etc., as well, muscle contusion, bone contusion, ligaments, and fracture. And if there is reason to believe that there's a high index of suspicion of a fracture, you know, for example, in an elderly who has osteoporosis, then I think MRI is probably the single best test to do.
Yeah, and maybe I can get some of these examples from you and put them up on the website if people are interested to take a look at this. And, you know, I had a 95-year-old lady about a year and a half ago that we were doing a health fair where she lived, and she specifically asked to have x-rays there that she could understand what an x-ray is and what it looks like. And I know a lot of my patients have never even heard their own heartbeat.
Indeed.
So, you know, I take my stethoscope off and I let them hear their own heartbeat or feel their own pulse, and I think there is tremendous interest in that. Okay, vertebral fracture, spine fracture. I'll start with Debbie again. Tell us something about spine fractures and when they happen, what symptoms tell us that there might be a spine fracture.
Well, in regards to spine fractures, they can be caused by multiple mechanisms of injury. For instance, if someone's in a car accident and they could particularly develop a spine fracture somewhere in the entire spinal column, versus it could be something as traumatic as that, versus just something as simple as a cough or a sneeze or bending and twisting. If, again, someone does have poor bone density or diagnosis of osteoporosis, they can do something as simple as bending to pick something up, coughing and sneezing, and develop a spine fracture. The interesting thing then in that regard is that either they can be very painful, which might lead someone to suspect that someone's developed a spine fracture. They often are painful very locally when someone presses on the spinal column, and then might do an x-ray, but oftentimes patients may be asymptomatic, meaning that they feel nearly nothing and it's an incidental finding. They get an x-ray for another reason, and you can maybe see that they have had a spine fracture at some point in the past.
Now let's just clear up something. People hear spine fracture and they think paralysis, that mm-hmm. you get paralyzed when your spine is fractured. Just clarify what the difference is and how you know whether you should worry that you're going to be paralyzed versus having a different kind of spine fracture.
Well, here I think that what I was speaking more of that I maybe could have clarified was vertebral compression fractures. So there's, when you talk about the entire spinal column, there's segmental vertebral bodies or vertebral segments, and they're made up of bodies and then a posterior portion. And this thick part that's in the front of the spine column, a big thick body, can sometimes become compressed and looked as if it's wedged.
It's kind of that thick portion. It's like it's shaped like a big marshmallow, I guess.
Exactly.
But hopefully it's not as mushy as a big marshmallow.
Exactly. And sometimes that can look as if someone's smushing the marshmallow from the top and the bottom somewhat. Most are very stable and don't cause nerve damage per se. With some impacts or injuries, you can have a little piece of the bone come backwards into the spinal canal, but again, that's more of a rare occurrence for it to be something that's actually problematic to the nerves. And that would be based on someone's complaints, whether they felt weakness or they felt some sort of loss in their ability to sense things in their legs, for instance, if they felt numb or tingling. And that would be part of the examination in that regard.
Yeah, so these bodies really are in the front part of the spine bone, and then there's a hole that goes up and down through all the different spine bones, and then there's the back part is what you can feel on your back.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the spines of the vertebrae. So we're talking about these bodies that are actually closest to your insides, if you will, and those are what, with osteoporosis especially, get smushed down and cause pain and also deformity, which can cause problems with walking and just aesthetically.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like how they look after some of these fractures. Now, osteoporosis. In some ways, maybe we should have started with osteoporosis, but now we have a background of these fractures and what happens, and these fractures occur mostly in older people. It's older people that are predisposed to them. Women, older women are more predisposed than men, and the root cause often is osteoporosis. So I'll start with you, Dr. Iqbal. You mentioned osteoporosis about being hard to see bones when you have osteoporosis on an x-ray. So that tells us something right away, that the bone is not as much bone to see as there was previously, and that's why you can't see them on x-rays. So let's start a discussion just a little bit about what is osteoporosis.
Well, osteoporosis is basically thinning of bone. By thinning, I mean that there are bony elements which give structure to bone, and those elements get thin for a variety of reasons. And as osteoporosis. It could be primary osteoporosis or secondary osteoporosis. The causes could include things that we don't even think about, like, for example, smoking. People who are on steroids, people who have, say, thyroid problems, diabetes mellitus, even people who are taking barbiturates, heparin. These are all drugs that are very commonly used, and we don't even know or think about it. But these are the things that can cause osteoporosis. And what's interesting about osteoporosis is that when you hear someone has an osteoporotic fracture, what is the first thing that comes to your mind in terms of location? Generally, you would hear that someone broke their hip. And that's very interesting, because I was looking at numbers from a 2002 study. Approximately, there are about 300,000 hip fractures due to osteoporosis in the U.S. a year. And this is from 2002. Guess how many spine fractures are there? 700,000. So spine fractures are actually about 2.5 times more common in osteoporotic patients as compared to hip fracture.
We hear about hip fracture because hip fracture usually involves a hospitalization, and the recovery period is a great many people who never recover from a hip fracture, and there's a high death associated in the year subsequent to a hip fracture. But the spine fracture causes a lot of misery.
Actually, it causes not only misery, but the mortality is very similar to hip fracture, believe it or not. Generally, these are the only type of fractures which are not treated in general in an orthopedic manner, meaning that they're treated with basically bed rest and braces so that the fracture is not stabilized. There's no fixation or gentle reduction, and patient is actually put on bed rest, which can actually cause the patient to lose up to 2% of their bone mass every week. The usual complications are generally related to their lungs and breathing ability. There's about 2 to 3 times increased mortality due to pulmonary problems, like, for example, pneumonias, atelectasis, it really is a spiral. It leads to a spiral where a patient is put on a bed rest, given analgesics, opiates, their breathing capacity is diminished, they cannot take deep breaths, they're in pain. So they're predisposed to pneumonias, they're predisposed to things like DVT or deep vein thrombosis, which can have a clot break and go to the lungs.
Those are clots that form in the legs and can break off and go to the lungs.
Their appetite diminishes because they can't move their bowels. Basically, you and I would think that that's a small problem, but for an elderly, that's a huge problem, especially when they have to take opiates to take care of the pain. And the whole thing leads to depression, and it almost becomes a spiral.
Debbie, what can you tell us about osteoporosis? I don't think there's really anything happy about osteoporosis.
Well, I think, as you mentioned before, women are at significantly higher risk than men. And there's, as far as some things you can't change about your risk factors, you know, one is age. Another can be race. Often Caucasian white women are at greater risk. We talked about your family history. If you have a mom that you remember being sort of hunched over in her older age, and you may be at a greater risk for osteoporosis, or if you remember her having fractures. Very thin women, people who have been thin their whole life, can be at a greater risk. So there are some things you can't change, but then I think oftentimes we don't talk about some of the things that we can change, one being our calcium intake, especially when we're young. By the time we realize we have osteoporosis or do have osteoporosis, often we've already been beyond that point, but people build up their bone density by the time they're in their 30s, usually, and then that's been your peak, and from there it sort of diminishes. But
and that's why it's so important to prevent that that leaching, that diminishing of bone density right from when it starts.
Exactly. If we can help prevent it, if you can take in enough and be active enough,
And exercise and is key.
One of the things that we like to focus on, and I have a particular interest in, is the fact that exercise does seem to stimulate bone health, bone density, and also some bone restructuring. So a more active lifestyle, especially bearing weight through the heel of the foot and up through the body, tends to stimulate bone growth, turnover, and a positive build-up. Also, things like smoking adversely affects bone health. Caffeine intake, more than 3 cups of coffee a day or caffeinated beverages a day, can actually have a negative effect on bone health.
And alcohol.
Alcohol, exactly, can also have a negative effect. So there are some things we can take an active part in, despite if the things we can't change, there are many things we can try to optimize a situation.
And then there's the sunshine factor. And what about sunshine?
Well, sunshine helps to convert vitamin D in our body to an active form that helps us absorb calcium through our gut. And that when we eat calcium, we're better able to take it in if we have the right form of vitamin D in our body also.
So we need both calcium supplements, vitamin D, and as much sunshine as possible.
Everyone
should go to Florida or Arizona during the winter in Buffalo. And certainly when it's been a summer like this, everyone should be outside and get in as much as they can.
Yeah,
Well, we're gonna take a quick break and listen to the words of this song. It's very appropriate to what we're talking about right now and what you shouldn't do to keep your bones strong, and we'll come right back and we'll continue our talk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you are good for nothing, lazy bone. Long as there was chicken gravy on your rice, everything is nice. Long as there's a watermelon on the vine, everything is fine. You got no time to work, you got no time to play. You're busy doing nothing all the livelong day. But you won't ever change, no matter what I say. You just made that way. Lazy bones, sleeping in the sun. How you expect to get your day's work done? You'll never get your day's work done. Sleepin' in the noonday sun. Lazy bones, sleepin' in the shade. How you expect to get your cornmeal made? You'll never get your cornmeal made. Sleepin' in the evening shade. Now when them taters need sprayin', I bet you keep praying that the bugs fall off of the vine. And when you go fishing, I bet you keep wishing that the fish won't grab at your line. You're no lazy bones, loafing all the day. How you expect to make a dime that way? You'll never make a dime that way. You never hear a word I say. I know you keep praying that the bugs fall off of the vine. And when you go fishing, I know you keep wishing that the fish won't grab at your line. You're no lazy bones, loafing all the day. Tell me, how you expect to make a dime that way? Oh, you'll never make a dime that way. Well, looky here, you never hear the word I say. Sleeping all the day, you were good for nothing, lazy bone.
What a great tune. This is Dr. Rob Stahl back with What Should You Expect at Your Age? We're going to continue talking about hip fractures, spine fractures, and osteoporosis with my two guests, Dr. Iqbal, an interventional radiologist, and Dr. Bergfeld, a specialist in rehabilitation medicine. Again, many thanks to Buffalo Spine and Sports Institute, and I'll give you their phone number, 626-0093. That's a group of which Dr. Bergfeld is a member of rehabilitation specialists and other specialists to help you with your back pain, hip pains, knee pains, and also functional problems that related to that. And Dr. Iqbal's group, Vascular Interventional Associates, 852-1977. If you would like to look into a non-invasive or a minimally invasive approach to your problems. I think we have a phone call, and why don't we take that? Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Self.
Yes.
Thank you very much for this wonderful, informative program. I truly do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
My name is Jean, and I'm actually a young woman of only 57. But I have severe osteoporosis, and I have a question for you.
Yes, go right ahead.
Is there any test besides a DEXA scan that can identify weak bones that may be in serious danger of a fracture? And the reason I'm asking this is so that you don't have to guess when you want to do a good exercise program and a specific one. Like if you had a weak link in your spine or your hip was, close to fracture, you would want to know that before you started a specific program. And the numbers that you get from a DEXA scan are just such a general number. So that's my question.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think a lot of people, my patients and young women like yourself that might be approaching an age of menopause or past menopause where bone density does go down, and you've obviously been diagnosed as having severe osteoporosis, there's a big fear. You don't want to get a fracture. You don't want a hip fracture or a spine fracture. You get a number from a scan, and we'll talk about what a DEXA scan is, and it shows you have severe osteoporosis. So what do you do? Do you not do anything for fear of breaking something, or do you do things like Dr. Bergfeld was saying, put the pressure on the bones to help maintain the bone density and not let it get any worse? And I'll turn to my guests. Dr. Iqbal, why don't we start with you?
I really don't know of any other specific enough bone density test except the bone density scan that that we're talking about here. I think that the other portion of the question probably would be best addressed by Dr. Bergfeld, who's expert in this area.
Yeah, I'll just jump in. Why don't you just define what the DEXA scan is for us, and so people are aware. And also there are screening clinics or screening programs where they might put your heel in a device and say that they're testing your bone density, and that's a way to screen for for thin bones. Is there value to that? If people have to pay for that, is it worth paying for that? Is that a waste of time? And should there be a standard test that people take to definitively, or as close as definitively as possible, establish how thin their bones are?
Again, I think I'm going to ask Dr. Bergfeld on her opinion of that, because, on our end, we do a test, but we don't really look at the implications before and after as a clinician would. So probably better if I ask them.
Okay, Demi. So there's several things here, it's a big burden we're placing on you, and there might not be a specific answer, unfortunately. And if there was, then we'd be in a lot better shape in preventing hip fractures and spine fractures. 100 years from now, doctors will be probably saying, that Dr. Stahl, he had to deal with hip fractures and spine fractures, and that Dr. Bergfeld, and that Dr. Iqbal. 100 years from now, we'll probably have the answers. But where do we stand right now? Is there a way to know when you're going to break a bone, and what do you do when you've been diagnosed with severe osteoporosis? Two, are there any better tests now or on the horizon, or can you get two tests together to give you a better idea? And three, is there a value to screening tests that use different techniques than just the DEXA scan? And while you're doing all this, say a little bit about what a DEXA scan is. You're on the spot.
Right. Well, I think I'll just start with what I do know about the tests to diagnose osteoporosis. And as we've talked about, the DEXA scan being the most clinically useful, I believe, and as close as we're coming to, say, a gold standard of diagnosis, something that people are using as the for the diagnosis of osteoporosis. And generally what you're given after they do a DEXA scan, and they're looking at different parts of the body, including the hip and the vertebral bodies, sometimes the wrist, there's multiple areas they can look at, but they're trying to give you a score related to a 20-year-old's peak bone density. And so they're considered sort of the standard, that age group with a peak mean bone density. And then you're put somewhere with your bone density results on a scale of that. So normal would be anywhere from what we call standard deviation, so everything kind of gets put on a curve. And a lot of fancy statistics that someone smarter than I am figured out, but if you fall within a standard deviation below that and then or above, you're considered within a normal range. And then if you fall below that, you're considered osteopenic, meaning your bone density is a little bit low, but you're not considered in the osteoporotic category. And then if it's at 2.5 standard deviations below that mean, again, for a 20-year-old, you're considered osteoporotic. And that's sort of where the diagnosis comes from. They also have other scores called Z-scores, which will put you against age matching, so meaning that they'll put you with people also in your own age group and sort of tell you where you compare along those lines. I think that those tests are useful from both a standpoint of telling you where you sit on the scale of your bone mineral density, so saying that you do have osteoporosis, and you also can follow them over time and see if there's improvement in your bone density, so with either medications, exercise, whatever regimen you're taking on to try to improve what you do have. As far as the screening tools, I'm not terribly familiar with what exactly they're doing now in the screening vans. But I do know that there are often people who are misdiagnosed, told either that their bone density is normal versus it's not normal, and then it could be vice versa. So I think that if you have a concern for it, you have some of the risk factors that we've been talking about today, I think it's worth talking to your doctor about having the actual DEXA scan when you're looking at your entire health picture.
And the DEXA scan, can you tell us a little bit about what that is? I think its full name is a dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
But it is a fairly new technique. I think over the past 10 years or so it's been developed, and it is the best right now. And I think the value of that test, when I send my patients for it, and I send many patients for it, is that it tells you where you are, and in a sense can scare someone into doing something. A lot of patients don't want to do anything unless they have a number that shows that something bad might happen mm-hmm. to them if they don't do something. And you mentioned that about exercise, that exercise is part of getting your bone density to its maximal level. So to answer the caller's question, exercise certainly should not be stopped. Are there any specific exercises that should be avoided in someone who has osteoporosis? I think that might go a long way to help answer her concerns.
Well, I think when you're thinking about exercise and osteoporosis, there's sort of two different benefits to the exercise. I think that one is the benefit of potentially increasing bone mineral density and increasing the strength of your bones and some of the mechanical properties of your bones and the outer part of them. And then I think the other benefit of exercise can come from preventing falls. So one part would be, specifically to the caller's question, doing things like walking. Again, we talked about weight-bearing exercise, and that would be a good place to start, where if you're just walking whatever your tolerance is on a daily basis and trying to build that up, whether it be 15 minutes to start and then building up to 20 minutes maybe a day, that can be helpful. The other kind, and then it, sometimes you can progress in a program beyond that, a more maybe functional sort of exercise program, things that we do are squats and lunges, but that would be if that would be under a more supervised kind of program, not maybe just to start on your own. The other benefit of an exercise program, especially a strengthening program, is not just from the bone density part, but also from, again, the strengthening part. A lot of fractures, although we can't predict which bones are necessarily at greater risk than others, most fractures occur from falls, or positions that we put our body in that might not optimize the pressure that we're putting through our spine. So one could be fall prevention. Important things in that regard are strength training, because falls are often due to decreased balance, and decreased balance is often due to actually decreased strength. And then another thing is just taking a look in, around your house. For instance, people who feel like their balance is poor should probably maybe wear supportive shoes around the house. For instance, running shoes or sneakers. You can pick up rugs that you might trip on, other things that maybe would put you at an increased risk of falling and sustaining something like a wrist fracture or a hip fracture.
Another thing is to improve your balance. And Tai Chi, I know, is a modality that people find very relaxing. It's a group activity and also helps improve balance. Are you using Tai Chi or recommending Tai Chi to your patients?
We do have a Tai Chi instructor at our particular facility. It is a great exercise program also. It does improve balance, and it improves balance through strengthening. And then we also would advocate doing an exercise program that mimics what you do in everyday life. Things like if you have to go down and pick up something from the ground and move, we would teach you the proper ways to do that and strengthen the muscles, especially these butt muscles that get weak on us, that help us to do those sort of things. Really importantly, in order to prevent fractures as well, would be maintaining your spine in as straight or what we call neutral position as possible. So trying not to do things where you're hunched over, and if you're picking up something from the ground, not just completely bending through your spine, actually bending at your knees and hips. We often hear about that lift with your legs. That sort of goes back to that old idea of bending at the knees and hips and not so much through your back lift things.
So my grandmother, when she kept pulling my shoulders back and telling me to stand up straight, she was really looking out for me as I got older.
Yes.
And not just as a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to Dr. Iqbal. And you're doing a procedure that can help restore that posture and relieve pain after someone does get a fracture. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Until now, or until last few years, the spine compression fractures were being treated exclusively with braces and bed rest, and which basically requires a patient to be confined to bed for a few weeks, typically about anywhere from about 4 to 8 weeks, and to let the fracture heal. What happens with the compression type of fracture is that the anterior or the front of the spine is where there's the most deformity. The vertebral body or that marshmallow analogy that you had given earlier.
And that causes people to bend forward, right? And that's why you see, you know, a lot of these older women that it's called a dowager's hump, like where they're really hunched over and can't even stand up straight in many cases.
Exactly, because the center of gravity has shifted forward. And to compensate for that, what happens is that these old ladies or victims of these fractures, they have to kind of throw out their hips towards the front, forward. And then to compensate for that, there's usually a buckling of the knee. That whole shift of the center of gravity puts additional strain on the posterior ligaments of the spine, and there is more weight on the anterior of the spine, which is already compromised. And so with time, that compression becomes worse and worse. And not just that, but it also predisposes the adjacent levels to become more susceptible to fracture after having that initial fracture.
And then you mentioned also that when this deformity occurs, it affects your ability to breathe, because it affects your whole rib cage, and that predisposes to pneumonia and illnesses related to problems with breathing in
indeed,
as well as you can.
Indeed, as mentioned above the pain comes from that micro movements every time you move with the periosteum. So what happened was that a few years ago, vertebroplasty got started, where you actually put small needles into the spine from a posterior approach again and inject a liquid cement, which kind of stabilizes that bone into its current form and it kind of like freezes that bone into the state that
so it doesn't crunch down anymore, but it doesn't restore its previous normal way that it should be.
It takes care of the pain, and but there were significant reports of complications with the liquid cement traveling into the vasculature, into the spinal canal, etc. A refinement of the procedure, a new procedure called kyphoplasty, where you actually try to restore by elevation of the end plates of the bone using balloons, and then to kind of compact down the remaining bone by creating two voids in the middle and then filling those voids with more of a putty-like cement that does not travel into the blood vessels, and this restores the height of the spine. Now let me add that it usually does not restore 100% of the height, because unfortunately, in medicine, nothing is really 100%. But there is an attempt to restore height, and the earlier you catch it, the better the restoration of height.
How many of these have you done, and what kind of success have you had? What failures may you have had that people should know about?
Sure. Well, it's back, and I've been actually a very slow process of education, educating the patients and the doctors that this is available. We've done about 10 to 12 of these procedures. It seems like recently, in recent weeks, we're doing almost 2 to 3 every week. The success rate in terms of pain relief has been excellent. Most patients have been able to go the following day. In terms of height restoration, generally the earlier we catch it, the better the restoration, because there is a point where a vertebra becomes almost like a pancake, or it's also called vertebra plana. At that point, you really can't restore too much height.
You can't get the balloon in to raise it up, and
everything is just compressed in. So the earlier you catch it, the better the results. And as I mentioned, that we haven't had an incident where we could not do the procedure, or where I saw any complications so far.
And how many of these are being done nationally now or internationally?
There are probably about 100,000 of these procedures done in the U.S. up to this point. And this is probably in its sixth year it being an accepted procedure in the U.S.
Well, it sounds fascinating and certainly something to consider. Debbie, have you had experience with this in, in Chicago, or what's the view of a rehab medicine doc with regard to a kyphoplasty?
Well, when I was in Chicago, it's a pretty popular procedure. They do have a large interventional radiology department where I trained, so it was a relatively common procedure with, as you just mentioned, low complication and side effects. And from the patients that I have treated who have undergone kyphoplasty, they've had good results for the most part, especially with pretty significant pain relief, which sometimes can be important. Most people feel better a few months after having a compression fracture, but again, without something like kyphoplasty, often they do continue to have that deformity of their spine.
And what I deal with every day is you control pain, you try to relieve pain, and you should be able to relieve pain, but usually the medications that might be given to relieve pain in an older person are very tricky. They can cause a lot of problems. They can cause confusion. They can, if you give something like ibuprofen, Motrin, it can cause ulcers. It can cause severe constipation, and Dr. Iqbal mentioned these things. And if you can do a procedure that gets to the root of the problem and relieves and takes care of that problem and relieves the pain that way, you can avoid all of that. And I think that's what's especially exciting about the kyphoplasty. I'm sure, as a rehab medicine doc, you want to do the things to avoid complications as well. Let's quickly, we only have a few minutes left, let's go through the specifics of treating osteoporosis, preventing and current treatment. And also, when we're talking about testing to detect osteoporosis, one thing we didn't talk about is doing blood tests to test for thyroid problems, to test for hyperthyroid problems, to test for diabetes, to test for excessive steroid production in your body. These are all very important, especially in someone who has premature severe osteoporosis. So there's a panel of blood tests that are very important to be able to detect. And it's not just a calcium level. We're talking about calcium. We're talking about phosphorus levels in your blood. We're talking about a thyroid-stimulating hormone that might be worthwhile to check and might come up with other problems that are producing the osteoporosis. So as far as testing to detect osteoporosis, let's not forget those blood tests that are important in screening as well. So treatment, we talked about calcium supplements, and there's the problem with osteoporosis generally rears its ugly head after menopause. And it's important that as soon as menopause is beginning and even getting up to that age to have the adequate calcium supplements, vitamin D. Why don't you go on and tell us, Debbie, what your recommendations are to your young adult women and then your older adult women. Let's compare a 50-year-old to an 80-year-old and what's your recommendation specifically. And it might vary from patient to patient as to specific dosages. But let's go through that.
In regards to treatment of someone who's been diagnosed as
Someone who has osteoporosis or to prevent. So we're talking about calcium supplements. What's the recommendation for calcium supplements and what you recommend generally to your patients?
Well, currently the recommendation is once you become perimenopausal, meaning someone who's starting to go through menopause, they usually say about 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day. I always tell people that I think it is best to try and get that through your diet. If we're eating the right kinds of things, milks, cheeses, broccoli, collard greens, green leafy vegetables, I think that it is possible through our diet to get a lot of that calcium naturally, but certainly supplements Vitamins are not a bad idea either. And then in addition, we talked about vitamin D, which you need about 400 to 800 international units is the recommended dose for the proper absorption. So you're, the amount that you should be taking in does increase. When you're very young, you should be getting close to 1,500 milligrams. And then as you approach menopause, once a woman does become perimenopausal, meaning around the time of menopause, her bone density actually does decrease faster for a few years than in the years prior, where it can be up to 1% per year. So from about 0.2 to 1% from the age of 30 on, it accelerates a bit to 3 to 4% for a few years around menopause. Then I think some decisions often that I make would make in conjunction with a primary care doctor or an OB would be hormone replacement therapy, since estrogen takes place, but then your risk factors for cancers comes into play. So there are other medications. If you've been diagnosed with osteoporosis, one group is called bisphosphonates. Most people know the name Fosamax and Actonil are the trade names. And there's also what we call selective estrogen receptor modulators, and one of those is Evista.
So these are all things that you may or may not be on. I'll try to put up some information, links on the website. There's an excellent brochure I just got from the Harvard Medical School, Boosting Bone Strength. You might try their website. Thanks so much. We ran out of time. We could talk for another hour, I'm sure. Thanks so much to Debbie Bergfeld of Buffalo Spine and Sports Institute, who was also a sponsor of the show. Thank you so much for that. And Dr. Iqbal of Vascular Interventional Associates, doing some fantastic things to really change, go to the root cause of problems and help relieve pain and help people live a happy and healthy life after vertebral fractures with his kyphoplasty procedure. You can reach Dr. Iqbal at his office, 852-1977, and Dr. Bergfeld, 626-0093. Don't hesitate to call me either if you have any questions or you'd like a CD of this or previous shows at 636-7531. Next month's show will likely be September 12th, as Labor Day is the first Monday of the month, I believe. So come back to WHLD at 3 p.m. on September 12th, and this is Dr. Rob Stahl, and I'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to At Your Age with Dr. Rob Stahl. Tune in again next month, that's right, on that 12th of the month for this radio broadcast, At Your Age with Dr. Rob Stahl, geriatrician. Right now on the outside, we're looking at temperatures of 86 degrees on the outside.